grandiose Arab dictator, an extreme hawk running Israel, and a Democrat in the White House who's facing re-election with a failing foreign policy. It may sound familiar, and it's an unlikely premise for peace in the Middle East, but of course that is precisely the cast of characters who actually created the Camp David peace agreement between Egypt and Israel in 1978. Lawrence Wright takes us inside Camp David in his book 13 Days in September, published by Knopf. Wright is a reporter for The New Yorker, the author of a Pulitzer Prize-winning book on Al-Qaeda called The Looming Tower, and most importantly for this project, perhaps, he's a playwright. Because 13 Days weaves together politics, history, and an intimate psychological portrait of three world leaders facing their own demons in each other's presence for 2 weeks while the rest of the world holds its breath. Welcome to this episode of the Lionel Gelber Podcast. We're hosting discussions with five authors whose works are shortlisted for the 2015 Lionel Gelber Prize for Best Book in International Relations. The prize is sponsored by the Lionel Gelber Foundation and the Monk School of Global Affairs in the University of Toronto in partnership with Foreign Policy Magazine. I'm Rob Steiner. Lawrence Wright joins me now from Austin, Texas. Lawrence, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Rob.
One thing that had never really struck me, or I never realized, you know, I was sort of watching these events as they unfolded as a kid a little bit, and of course I learned a lot about it as I grew up as a journalist, but I'd never really thought about the fact until I read your book that the whole premise of this, which is that you could squirrel away three world leaders with pretty much a big chunk of their cabinets for 2 weeks without interruption at Camp David, and make sure that they were only focused on one thing. No interruption, no press conferences, no quick flights out to do, you know, Carter was potentially involved in a re-election campaign, none of that stuff. 2 weeks just focused on one thing. Is that what it takes actually to try to get peace in the Middle East? Is that even possible anymore?
Well, people are always asking, you know, could we do it now? And my response is, you couldn't do it then, but they did. You know, it was just as preposterous in 1978 as it is in current times, because, you know, you look at what, you know, just take the example of Carter, you know, midterm elections, failing presidency, his prime rate was 20%, we're in stagflation, you know, his energy bill was up for grabs, you know, he was a very besieged president, and then suddenly he goes off on a mountaintop in Maryland for 2 weeks. And you can say the same thing for Sadat and Begin. They were both under a great deal of pressure. Not to mention the same time this was going on, the Shah was going down in Iran, a major world event. So all of these pressures were on top of these leaders. And yet, you know, well, we should also point out none of them thought it was going to take that long. You know, Carter thought, you know, 3 or 4 days. Begin had budgeted 2 or 3, so you know it was not something they intended to do.
But did they really focus that whole time? The book really gives you the impression that this is all they were thinking about the whole time. Is that actually, was Carter actually sitting just focused on this, not calling congressmen about this or that legislation going before them, or worrying about Iran or the Soviet Union at the time? He was really that focused just on the Middle East for 2 weeks.
There were some. He calls, you know, he was, you know, when he tried to slip away and play tennis, for instance, you know, there was a phone at the tennis court. He would have to take the calls. But for the most part, he let Mondale, his vice president, run the shop while he was at Camp David. And similarly with Sadat and Begin, you know, they were away from the affairs of state, and they were hard to reach. It was difficult to get them on the phone. So, you know, not to say that the countries ran themselves, but they had delegated those authorities.
You know, of all of these, I suppose like you come back to Jimmy Carter because of all of the portraits that you have in here, and we'll speak about Begin and Sadat as well, but Carter was the most surprising to me in this. I mean, here's a guy, he didn't have to do this. This was not a major policy plank for, in fact, it wasn't a policy plank for him or for the Democratic Party. His advisors warned him not to. I used to work in politics, and I can imagine just sitting down with my principal and saying, this is insane. Not just because if it failed, he would wear it, but even if he did well at that, he would have lost his time on all these other files. Why did he do this?
Well, he told me he did it because he thought God had put him in that office in order to bring peace to the Middle East. And he said something rather similar to that to Walter Mondale on his very first day in the White House. He said that bringing peace to the Middle East was going to be his highest priority. So, I think he really did have the feeling that, he was being, he had a divine mandate. But I have to say, there was very little evidence of divine assistance during those 13 days. If anything, it was just a headwind. He really had to struggle. There was no evidence that, I asked him when I was down in Plain, Mr. President, you're a student of the Bible. If you read the Bible, what makes you think that God wants peace in the Middle East? It's a pretty bloody story. And he said, because, we follow the Prince of Peace. He was talking about the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the Old Testament, which is the testament that Fagan was reading, and then in the Quran, they were reading very different chapters.
But it's interesting. The part of this actually suggests one of the things that's missing in the whole peace process and the U.S. attempt to mediate and the Israeli perspective on it and the maybe in the Arab perspective on it as well is actually, I hate to say it, but is actually sort of a, a sophisticated view of religion. In other words, a sense of religiosity that is or spirituality or something like that. That this should be a component of the conversation without becoming crazy about it. No, we're not talking about fundamentalism here, but some awareness that this is a very special part of the world and being informed by the best values of one's religion. It's almost like that's missing from the conversation right now. If you look at the different characters,
yeah, it's a really good point, Rob, because we think of religion being so responsible for the violence, especially in the Middle East. And yet, it also, in the example of Camp David, you see that it plays a real role in bringing the peace, because each of these men has a, I think they each see themselves in a prophetic tradition, and that they feel the burden of history and of their faith on their shoulders.
So Begin, if we shift to Begin then, it's interesting to sort of introduce this notion of religion and sort of a feeling a prophetic burden to Begin. I'd come to at this before reading your book with a very different sense of him. I'd sort of bought into this trope that the same way that it took Nixon and a Kissinger to make peace with Mao, it took a hardliner like Begin to make peace with Egypt. But then I read this book, and piece after piece, day after day after day, it's sort of like Carter and Sadat keep getting closer and closer, and every time they get close, Begin says no. And it's almost like the peace happened in spite of Begin as opposed to, with him. Did he contribute something to all of this?
Yeah, despite the fact that he was so obstructionist from the very beginning, and even up to the very last day, he was willing to tear up the whole thing. Everybody in his delegation was more in favor of peace than he was. This is, strikingly true. But it's also the fact that Begin picked those people to be a part of his delegation. So when I look at, this extremely complicated man and all the mixed emotions he had about trying to fashion a peace for Israel that would involve the sacrifice of land. This was, contrary to everything in his political history. I think he, he picked those advisors to help him get to the place where he could do that. And it was an internal struggle for him. You could just see him wanting to have peace, but just cannot imagine making the sacrifice that Carter is demanding of him in order to achieve.
What's that internal struggle about with Menachem Begin? Apart from just sort of the strategic concerns of giving up Sinai and all that, there's something much deeper going on with him.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was a Polish Jew. His first memory is of a Polish soldier flogging a Jew in a public park. During the Holocaust, he was not in Poland, but his father was drowned in the River Bug. And his mother was ill with pneumonia when the Nazis arrived, and they went through the hospital and murdered the patients in their bed. just think about the historical weight that he carried around with him, that when he arrived in what was then mandated Palestine after the war, his whole political mission was to expand the zone of safety for Jews. That's all he cared about. And that meant that when Israel occupied Sinai, that was an additional barrier to those Egyptian forces. That it seemed like a strategic separation between these two countries that had been at war four times in the space of a generation. So he was being asked to protect Jews, and of course the best way for that to happen would be to make peace with the only Arab enemy that really posed a threat to Israel's existence.
So here's the irony. It is actually a very biblical irony that every impulse is actually to protect Jews by creating more space between Jews and their enemies. And then the options put on the table, the best way to protect Jews is to make peace with that very enemy.
Well, and what is peace? It's a signed piece of paper. Mm. And, that compared to 150 miles of Sinai sand that stands between you and the Egyptian tanks, this was a very, very hard thing for him to trust his enemy.
And why did he even take the invitation to come to Camp David? I mean, he couldn't turn Sadat down when Sadat got on a plane to fly to Jerusalem. But as you point out in the book, between the time that Sadat, this is another thing that I sort of had forgotten in my whole sort of vague recollection of the events, between the time that Sadat came to Jerusalem and the time that both Sadat and Begin went to Camp David to meet with Carter, a great deal of tension had returned. I mean, basically, you were back to square zero.
Yeah.
So why had he even taken the invitation to come?
Well, it's difficult for the Prime Minister of Israel to turn down the President of the United States when he's making this offer for a peace settlement. But he didn't think that they were actually going to negotiate peace. What he thought would be that they would have a conversation and then launch a peace process that would go on for an extended period of time with their second negotiating, details that would take years. That was what he really had in mind. And, he was caught short when Carter explained to him that, no, we're going to make peace here at Camp David, and we'll stick it out as long as it takes.
And when you describe that, Begin, and we'll go on to Sadat and say, because he's obviously equally intriguing and complex here in a different way. But when you talk about Begin coming with exactly the advisors who he knew would push him away from his comfort zone, as we'd call it today, is that manipulative in the sense that, he wanted to politically, was that a political calculation? I want to continue to appeal to my hardliners, but I want to actually be able to do something here, so I'm going to bring the doves. Well, is it a bit of good cop, bad cop? Or is that, I don't know, is that something deeper, more intimate, more complex in the man, bringing exactly the people he knew would oppose him?
I think he didn't need to bring anybody to reinforce his hawkishness. And of course, it is another thing to take into account. It reflects the arrangement of Israeli politics, which are coalition politics. And in order for him to try to garner an agreement that would have a broad consensus, he would need that kind of endorsement. Mainly, the people that his principal advisors were people that, Moshe Dayan, one of the most titanic figures in Israeli history, but a man disgraced when he came to Camp David because of the 1973 war. And Ezra Weizman, who, was really the founder of the Israeli Air Force and had really created the Likud party that Begin founded. He needed political advisors like that and their credibility to make the kind of agreement that would be sold to his Israeli constituents. But when he got home, his own party was very opposed to him. Mm. A lot of them greeted him at the airport shouting Munich, Munich, and carrying black umbrellas.
Black umbrellas, yeah. It's a jar. It's something I'd never even heard about. So switching to Sadat for a second, you describe Sadat, and Sadat's a very different type of character, a man, yeah. Sort of a man of destiny, an elegant man, a man of part, you almost picture a model, a movie star. And yet for all of that, what he did actually sort of survived his, not only did it survive his death, it survived the rise of jihadism in Egypt, which you point out in the Looming Tower is in no small part an Egyptian movement. I mean, what he did, even though he was apart from Egypt in a sense, really tapped into something Egyptian, it sounds.
Yeah, I think I was living in Egypt when Nasser died in 1970 and Sadat became president. At the time, people thought he was kind of a clown. He was such a small figure compared to Nasser, as people believed. And he'd missed the revolution. He'd been in a movie, a double feature. And people didn't take him seriously. And so his rise, it was so surprising, you know, that within a year he had thrown all these Nasser cronies in prison. And then, you know, he kicked the Soviets out, and then, you know, he made that dramatic trip to Jerusalem. And by that time, you know, he had riveted the world's attention. Nobody really knew very much about him when he came into office. He had one overriding goal, which was to spare Egypt another war that would possibly destroy it. One thing, Egypt had borne the brunt of all the Arab wars against Israel and lost in each occasion. It had been a terrific toll in manpower and expense, and it was holding the country back. And he was also very much afraid of the Israeli nuclear power. So, you know, the ironic thing is, for Sadat, there was only one way to achieve peace, and that was to wage the 1973 war, which, from his perspective, was very limited goals, to get across the canal and force the issue. And, of course, you know, war, the Israelis regarded, you know, war as an existential problem, you know, that this is not just a battle for territory. It's a battle for our lives, for the future of Judaism. Mm. So it was a shattering experience for Israelis. But it did lead to Camp David.
And by the sounds of it, actually sort of created a foundation for an idea of peace that Egyptians just couldn't ignore. I mean, having actually succeeded in some limited goals in 1973 and then lost nonetheless, is that why what Sadat did had the staying power in Egypt to outlast him? Is that why we haven't gone back to war between Egypt and Israel despite all sorts of temptations since then?
You know, this peace is called a cold peace on both sides. It's a hated peace. It's not loved, and yet it's so vital. Imagine the Middle East without it right now. One thing that you could, if you work in the Middle East a lot, as I have, one thing you learn is things can always get worse. And it would be so much worse if, there were not this architecture of peace between the two most powerful nations in the region. And I think each side, even though they resent it, they've never embraced each other. They both realize that they're so much better off with this treaty than without it. And, you know, actually, I think Egypt and Israel are closer now than they have ever been.
What does Jimmy Carter think of this, looking back on it? He's the one principal of these events who you were still able to speak to.
Yeah, you know, this was the high watermark for his presidency. It's a historic moment. And to be frank, I didn't, you know, I lived in Georgia when Carter was governor, and I, you know, voted for him as president, but I never saw him as a strong figure. The man that went to Camp David really surprised me. I didn't mean to try to rectify his image for history, but I was completely stunned by, you know, his persistence, his imagination, and determination to bring this peace to pass. And you know, that I think it's worth capturing those qualities in Carter, because he's been so lost to history in other respects.
So we're 2 years away from, I mean, really to this month, to last week, I suppose, we're 2 years away from a new president. So if you can imagine on that day or that week of the transition, having to write a memo to her or him, giving them the lessons of Camp David, you know, if she or he wants to try to pursue something similar somewhere in the world. Right? Is there a lesson that you'd give the new president of the United States based on this experience?
Yes, indeed. I think that we all believe, I think it's all over the world, people think that the Middle East will never be resolved, that, you know, that this is an eternal problem, and that the Arabs and the Jews are doomed to be constantly fighting each other. But, you know, I grew up in the segregated South, and now we have a black man president. I grew up in a time when apartheid was, you know, a big issue that's long since been gone away. I grew up in the Cold War, and now the Soviet Union has dissolved. So history changes. And to say that peace is in the Middle East is not possible is the most pernicious obstacle to peace. Peace is possible. Camp David proves it.
It sounds like that's almost to get back, that's almost where the religious perspective, a healthy religious perspective on this stuff, can help lubricate the conversation.
Yeah, I believe you're right.
I want to ask just one last question, and here I'm going to put on my hat as a journalist and as someone who teaches journalists. You know, we're used to, you know, we almost assume that people who are writing Middle East and so on sort of are straddling the world of think tanks and politics or academia and politics, but you are actually the only one I know other than Robert Sherwood, who once wrote, you know, about FDR and wrote plays at the same time and served FDR. You're the only person I know who has been both a journalist at a very high level and a playwright at a very high level. And in fact, as I started reading this book, I was thinking this should be a play, and then I flipped over to your acknowledgments at the end and realized that that's exactly how this had started. I'm wondering, so you wrote this first as a play. Is there a lesson in here for journalism? Does a playwright have a lesson in here for journalism?
Well, I started getting interested. I've always loved theater, to preface this, but I think it was early 90s. I went to see Fires in the Mirror, the Anna Deavere Smith play about the Crown Heights tragedy. I was at the Public Theater, and I was knocked out because she's an actress, but she had gone around and interviewed all these people, as I would, as a reporter would. And then she'd gotten up there and reenacted them and created a story that had married journalism and theater. And I was electrified by this. I didn't know that was possible. And I always had in mind that I would like to do something like that. And after I wrote The Looming Tower, people were always asking me what it was like to talk to these people and be in that environment. So I decided I would tell the story of that adventure in the form of a one-man show. And I did that. And
did you act in that show?
I was the one man. Yeah. It later became an HBO documentary that Alex Gibney directed. But it was theater, but it was also journalism. And in a way, I reflected on the fact that, you know, who was the first journalist? If you imagine a group of cavemen, and, you know, they're wondering, you know, what's over the hill, and someone says, well, I'll go over the hill and take a look, and then comes back, and they're sitting around the fire, very much like what it looks like when you're sitting on stage and you can barely see people out there, and you're telling them what's over the hill. I think it's all a part of the journalist. It's just a different form of telling the story. And I did another one-man show about Israel and Gaza in New York and Tel Aviv. So I developed a taste for creating these kind of alternative theatrical journalistic presentations.
But with all due respect, it's even more than just another form of telling the story, because my sense is that a play allows you to explore the thinking and not just the issues, and the people and not just the issues. And that's what makes this book so rich, actually.
Well, you know, I might have adapted a book to write the play had the book that I wanted to adapt existed, but it didn't. There was a fine diplomatic study by William Quant, who was on Carter's National Security Council. But, you know, the kind of story that I was looking to tell, you know, hadn't been written. So I went, as I would as a journalist, I went to interview the Carters, and I went to Israel and Egypt to talk to the surviving members of those delegations. And I acquired quite a lot of material, and there were many, many stories that and characters that I would have included in the play if you could populate a stage with that many people. But fundamentally, I thought, you know, after I finished the play, there's still a lot more to say. But the play did give me an appreciation for the dramatic architecture that becomes a part of the book.
And it's, without spoiling it, I'll just, I mean, we all know how it ends, I suppose, but I didn't realize how close it came to ending a very different way. And with that, I'll bring us to an end, although I wish we could keep going on for another hour. There are so many questions I have. Lawrence Wright, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Rob. Thank you again.
Lawrence Wright is the author of 13 Days in September, Carter, Begin, and Sadat at Camp David. If you would like to hear more from the Lionel Gelber podcast series, we have discussions with 5 leading authors on international affairs this year, along with more than 25 others from the last 3 years. You can find them all on iTunes by searching for Lionel Gelber, that's G-E-L-B-E-R, or online at monkschool.utoronto.ca, that's monk is M-U-N-K, school.utoronto.ca/Gelber. I'm Rob Steiner, director of the Monk School's Fellowships in Global Journalism. Thank you for joining us.